Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, park fans. You know by now we are a podcast for theme park fans, and we're here every week just talking about things going on in the theme park world and having a bit of a chat and a debate about things that pique our interest. I'm Bex, this is Kev.
Hi everyone.
And this week we are looking globally. We're going overseas and we're bringing back a Parkcast favourite. He's been on a couple of times already and he's always fascinating to chat to. It's Mark Rosenzweig over in America.
Really happy to be with you guys again. Thanks for having me.
You are very welcome. We love having you here. If you don't know already, Mark works for 3DX Scenics. What's your job title there now?
I'm actually co-owner, so principal and chief business officer. So I run all the sales and marketing for all of our efforts in themed entertainment and other projects across our various industries that we serve.
Amazing.
But you're such a cool job.
It's one of those things. As an enthusiast, you're like, oh, I'd love to do something in the theme park world. And yeah,
that's amazing. The dream.
to co-own a mm-hmm. business working in theme parks. How cool is that? And you are a long-term roller coaster enthusiast. How long have you been an enthusiast for now?
It's 1978, I would say, at the age of two. My grandparents put me on a carousel and this is history. But my dad also would, take me on trips to Coney Island and Rye Playland and Six Flags Great Adventure growing up. I'm from Long Island, New York. So sometimes maybe those trips are on days when I should have been in school, but bonding with family is just as important as education. So
they had their priorities right. And look where it's got you now. You are where you are now because of that.
Bonding at a theme park as well. Where else better to spend time with family, you know?
Exactly.
That's a great thing to do.
Yeah. Amazing. So you are now based up in Ohio, very close to Cedar Point and Kings Island. So yeah, very jealous of your location in the world. And also as part of your job, you have recently been lucky enough to go to Epic Universe. Of course, the brand new theme park in Orlando, the new Universal Park, which does look epic, so much so that I've booked myself a flight to go and visit it. But you've been already, so I am quite interested to kind of get your feedback and your thoughts before I go. You can like help me out, tell me what to look out for. So you were there. This wasn't even a guest preview, was it? It was a contractor preview.
Yeah, it was for their contractor previews, which took place back in early April. So I was there, I believe it was April 2nd, if I'm not mistaken. It's almost overwhelming to walk into the gates of a brand new theme park, because brand new theme parks really aren't built anymore. I mean, no. This is the first new theme park built in Orlando since Disney's Animal Kingdom. I take that back. Actually, Universal's Islands of Adventure opened in 1999 and Animal Kingdom in 1998. There have been several water parks that have opened since then. And Fun Spot America, obviously, has built up their portfolio. But just to walk through the gates of this place after all the hype and, you know, watching the construction, I think everyone, Universal employees included, were watching, the helicopter shots of the park under construction. So, it really was kind of surreal to finally go in. And I would say for the really what Epic Universe does is it above everything else, I think it complements the rest of the, not only the Orlando theme park collection, but what Universal has. So they have three very distinct theme parks now. I know they count Volcano Bay as a theme park. I'll put that aside and call it a water park.
It is which is what it is.
Yeah, the water park.
It is. Volcano Bay, to me, is the best water park that I've been to in the world. I would say they have really succeeded in complementing their existing two parks, Universal Studios Florida and Islands of Adventure, in a way that now and also in the future, they will be able to sell those park hopper tickets and all the add-ons and all that. And I think they also have a multi-day park on their hands, because to really absorb all the details, one day is not going to cut it, unfortunately.
Which portal were you most excited to go and walk through?
I think initially it was probably Dark Universe. I think the surprise for me was the Wizarding World of Harry Potter Ministry of Magic was probably last on my list, because, you know, I had seen the other two Wizarding Worlds. And, you know, as things go with expectations and you go into a new park for the first time, the Wizarding World Ministry of Magic completely blew me away. You know, I mean, it is, first of all, it's built to full scale. So there's no forced perspective. So when you're walking down the boulevards, these buildings are full scale. And wow. I can't think of another themed entertainment project that just brings that amount of scale to the audience. You know, you're walking down the boulevard, the food and beverage, the show that they have there, which in a clever way, they put up the circus tent in the center of the land. It looks all tethered and worn, and it hides the fact that you're actually walking into a theater that can, you know, seat several hundred people. I love that kind of stuff.
The Ministry of Magic queue line just looks like nothing I've ever seen before. It's just like a different scale. I can't believe that it's a queue line. It's like the queue line's an attraction in itself.
You can just go in as well, can't you? I think.
I believe so. I'm not sure how they're going to be running it when the attraction's in full operation. Although it has opened to guests now with a virtual queue. We were able to walk the queue. The attraction had not opened to the public yet on our day. And I could say with confidence, it is the most impressive queue of any attraction in the world. And this is like, you know, I'm putting it on the level of, you know, growing up, I would say the Indiana Jones Adventure at Disneyland Park in California was the first of these like crazy scale queues where you're walking all the way out to the show building, not really knowing you're going under the railroad and all that. But just this, the sense of show and scale and immersiveness is on a level that I had never seen before. And I felt as though I had experienced an e-ticket walkthrough attraction without even sitting on the ride vehicle or experiencing the ride. It was completely satisfying just from that standpoint.
Incredible.
And are they using a lot of new technology at Epic that's never been done in the world before, Mark?
It's I would say updated, right? So, I mean, they're really using cutting edge technology in every possible way. We didn't really get to see the park after dark, which is when I'm told it really shines. Our day, I think the hours were 11 to 7. So we kind of saw it at dusk as we were leaving. But each land has its own, you know, whether it's audio or visual effects, lighting after dark. I have seen some videos of each land and they really, just from an immersive standpoint, they've really hit the ball out of the park, I would say.
That's amazing.
I've got to ask you, because the one thing that really made me go, I'm going to just book these tickets, I'm just going to go whilst I can, was the reviews coming through of Stardust Races. How was it for you, dare I ask?
It's spectacular. I mean, it's as good as a steel coaster on a flat site can possibly be. You know, I personally, I really love the heavy theme coasters like Velocicoaster, Jurassic World Velocicoaster, Islands of Adventure. I love how that has two distinct parts. The first part, you're launched into the Raptor Pen and you're cutting through rock work. And then you hit the second launch, which is the power launch. And then you do all these acrobatic elements over the park's lake, including the Mosasaurus roll at the end. But what Stardust Racers does, I mean, it's just straightforward. It's a beautiful ride aesthetically. The structure is gorgeous. The trains are gorgeous. And the highlight, the aesthetic highlight is the lighting on the train. So the ride itself is not floodlit at night. It is meant to look as though, you know, comets, meteors, whatever, just flying through the sky. I was able to see a few cycles running as we were walking to the car at dusk. And you could see, especially that celestial roll after the second launch where the trains intertwine both times. One really cool element on, well, two really cool things. For one, I can say with authority that the launches are super powerful. So for everyone that has said Mach Ride launch coasters, you know, Helix, Icon, you name them, they're like aggressive pushes versus like an aggressive launch like you would get on a ride like Tron at Fantasia. This is that. So the first launch is like a double launch. So you come out of the station, the tracks split, and then they align and you roll into the launch. And then halfway down the launch track, staters stop because that's actually the location of the transfer track. That's where the trains are transferred after hours. And then you hit a second set and you launch into that top hat. The second launch has a feature on it that I don't know a lot of people are talking about that kind of brought back the spirit of Dueling Dragons at Islands of Adventure, where the two trains hit the launch and the train that is lagging is given the ability to catch up. So when you exit the second launch, trains are neck and neck so that celestial roll is executed to perfection every cycle.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really cool feature. It kind of makes it questionable if you'd call it a racing coaster because you're guaranteed to be neck and neck at that point. But the rest of the ride is obviously, you know, you're racing, I guess. So,
yeah.
But either way, a tremendous ride. It was my favorite attraction that I experienced in the park that day. I did both tracks once. And I've heard some people say green is better, yellow is better. They're both about the same. I couldn't really tell one or the other, but and a huge people leader. I think the goal is for them to be running 3 or 4 trains on each track during
Wow.
So that's some serious capacity you've got there.
That's insane. I'm so relieved that you haven't said, yeah, it looks better than it rides. I'd be like, right, cancel my tickets.
I would say it's probably, now I haven't been on Hyperia Thor Park yet, but up to this point, my favorite mock coaster was Helix at Liseberg. And I think that I need to get back because it's been 10 years, but just based on those rides, I would say this is the best mock coaster I've been on.
You've not been on Ride to Happiness yet either.
I have not.
No. See, that's up there for me. So yeah, it'll be very interesting. Obviously a different type of coaster, but yeah, I can't wait to get on it. And I'm so desperate to get on it at night. It must have been heartbreaking for you as a coaster enthusiast to be leaving the park.
I was just happy to be there. You know, we were invited guests and I was thrilled to experience it with colleagues of mine in the industry. So, you know, just seeing, knowing all the hard work and the endless hours and effort that goes into these, you know, it's easy to critique things, but, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people and contractors and suppliers and you name it, poured their, you know, blood, sweat and tears into this thing. I think it's going to pay off. Again, there's not another park in Orlando that I could really compare it to. So it's kind of cool to have that another park that kind of spreads the crowds more and gives people more options.
Yeah. So I was going to say, how does it compare to the other two Universal parks there? But obviously you've made that point, having it's obviously very different. And because it's quite separate away, it has that kind of that feeling that you are. Whereas I guess with Islands of Adventure and Universal, you get like the Hogwarts Express that kind of you can connect the two, but this one is slightly out of the way, isn't it? Did you feel like that made a difference with it being slightly further away?
Hard for me to say because we stayed at a hotel off of iDrive and we just drove to Epic. So as far as we were aware, the other part of Universal didn't exist that day. We just drove and parked up and went to the park. But the opening day lineup for Epic is, it's different, obviously, but from a scope perspective is, to me, pretty close to what Islands of Adventure was when it opened in 1999. It has about the same number of attractions on opening and does a lot of the same thing where it takes rides and attractions that we're familiar with and just pluses them to the next level. So I think that's where, of course, there are a couple of first of their kind attractions like Battle at the Ministry. But even like Monsters Unchained, it takes that familiar KUKA robotic arm dark ride system and throws a twist in, right? So the robotic arm attaches to the seat from underneath as opposed to behind it. So the loading area is a turntable instead of a moving conveyor, if that makes sense. Like something you'd see on a Rapids ride or a log flume. Nonetheless, I mean, it's just, I feel like everything complementing everything is really, I think, the theme. You know, the nice thing is it's a new park. Its landscaping is going to grow in. The trees are going to grow. It needs more shade for sure. Yeah. It's a very hot park because it was built on a field. For the most part, you know, I think they've done what they set out to achieve. And that is to, you know, encourage people to book longer stays and add another day or two to their park ticket. At this point, I think you can only buy 1 day preview tickets to Epic or 1 day tickets once it opens on May 22nd. But I think it's only time probably within the year that you're able to add, you know, make it, they'll call it a 3 or 4 park hopper or park to park ticket. So,
yeah. Okay. Mark, I'm interested in your thought also because I've noticed that, and Disney did start doing this as well, that we've started to get a few copy and paste attractions across Universal and Disney, whether it's opened on one side of the world and then we get the similar thing built. We had it with like when Tower of Terror opened at California and then Paris built exactly the same thing. What are your feelings on that? Do you think each Universal should be unique to itself, or are you quite happy that there are these copy and paste attractions being placed around?
Yeah, I think from the element of research and development investment, financially, it makes sense for them to be able to rubber stamp attractions in strategic markets, right? So I don't, if Universal had another park in Atlanta, Georgia, let's say, I wouldn't encourage it to happen that close. But given in the US, their parks are 3,000 miles apart, and then across the rest of the world, they're really not in in an area that the average guest is going to be visiting more than one of them. So okay. I think market research, knowing which brands really tie to emotions of that market, I think drives that decision. And then the ride systems, I guess, as they master plan and lay the park out, you want to have different attractions in each category. So it's kind of like a playing chess, almost like picking and choosing and, you know, being strategic as far as how those dollars are spent. So I'm not necessarily against it. I wouldn't want to necessarily see Epic Universe as a park rubber stamp somewhere else, but the concept could if they mixed up the attractions, I think. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. It okay. is a really cool concept, I think, having that central point and then these lands are through portals and you can't see anything else from any of the other lands.
And I'll tell you, Celestial Park is just a crown jewel. It's gorgeous. Mm. It's everything that Universal Creative was setting out to do, putting the park back in theme park. That is what many of the executives had said. And it does that. And people are already just kind of relaxing, laying out on the grass. It's just a place to take a chill. Each of the lands are very... alive, full of energy, full of entertainment, a lot of streetmosphere, a lot of, I know this is a sore subject in the UK with all the recent cuts, but I'll say at Epic, every land had live entertainment. Every land had, whether it was a stage show, streetmosphere actors, character meet and greets, just incredible, especially in How to Train Your Dragon. That was probably the highlight of the land. Although I will say the sleeper ride at Epic that I don't think enough people are talking about is Hiccup's Wing Gliders. It may be the best family coaster that I've ever been on. I mean, it's right there. With
I've seen good things about it.
It's absolutely fantastic. The launches have kick to them. The ride's smooth. It's got great pacing. And it draws, ages 5 to 80, essentially, which is perfect. Mm.
And that whole How to Train Your Dragon land as well. I've seen some really impressive sort of, I'm going to say they're animatronics, but is that what we're calling? Like the dragons, but they're almost remote control. They're like fully animatronic, but they're out in the street like that. They look amazing.
Yeah. You want one for your house, right?
I do. I'd love one. Yeah. It's much more convenient than having a pet.
Yeah.
The one thing that I've seen, which looks a little bit weird, is on Curse of the Werewolf in Dark Universe, is you take your bag on with you. Is that right? And so it's got like this netting up around the coaster. That's a bit weird, isn't it?
I don't know. I the netting could very well be just to protect guests on the walkways from anything that might, that a guest might drop, because the ride is built in a very compact site on this almost like an island in the center of the land, and the walkways go directly under it at multiple points. That ride operationally impressed me because given how short it is, you think, oh, this is going to be, a capacity nightmare, but they actually are able to run three trains on it.
It's a swing launch as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Halfway through the ride, there is a swing launch feature that, as far as I'm aware, is the first of its kind. I've never seen a mid-course swing launch like that. That's intentional. But they have a separate load, unload, and a holding area, so three trains can be held at one time.
That's crazy.
That really, like, I know a lot of people were not let down, but kind of talking down of the attraction, but like, everything can't be an e-ticket. That's a big lesson that designers I think have learned over the years. You need to have filler attractions to absorb capacity to keep everything flowing. And Curse of the Werewolf, if people go in thinking of it as Flight of the Hippogriff, that's really what it is for that park. It's the family friendly. It doesn't spin too much. It's just the right amount of thrill. I would say on that like Big Thunder Mountain level, Flight of the Hippogriff level. So
cool.
Was it?
Amazing.
Well, I'm very excited to get there. Obviously, I'll report back on this podcast what my findings were. I know that when you went, the Super Nintendo World wasn't open, so you didn't get to do like Minecart Madness. We can't ask you about that, but I will report back. And we did,
which
touch
looks
on...
weird as a roller coaster. I'm like looking at this.
Well, we've said for years, haven't we? One day they'll come up with a roller coaster that leaves the tracks, and there we go.
I know. It's really weird.
One real highlight of Epic for me, because I like to eat, the food and beverage is next level. And
talk to me about these mac and cheese cones that I've heard about. Did you have
that
one of
those?
That
was not part of my day. There's only so much I could eat in one day. The name is escaping me now. I'll find it at some point and send it to you, Bex. But there was a restaurant in Ministry of Magic, the Goblet Noir, I believe it was called. I'm working off memory here. Really, really cool menu. A lot of German food. They had schnitzel and, all kinds of good stuff. Not the typical theme park food. But yeah. Above all that is how they're operating their quick service restaurants, which I really like. So you walk in, a host will seat you. So there's no queue. And then you scan the QR code on the table, which takes you to the Universal Orlando app. You order and pay for your food on the app. It knows what table you're in because you've scanned the QR code, and cast member brings you your food. So you've paid for it. You're sitting in air conditioning, which, it's like walking on the surface of the sun at the end of this time of year. And you get your meal and you move on. So it's just a very relaxing type of thing compared to, say, the two quick services at Diagon Alley and Hogsmeade, like Three Broomsticks, for example, where you get in a queue. And during peak dining hours, you can wait in that queue 20, 30 minutes just to order. Yeah. They've eliminated that. So operationally, I think that was a really good move. And I'm sure it saves them some staffing because you don't have to have all the staff at the registers, waiting. And I'm sure that they when you walk in, there was a bar and a couple of registers. So if you don't, for whatever reason, have a smartphone or you don't have the app or you don't have data or Wi-Fi, you can still order. So, but that saved a lot of time and hassle, I thought. So that was a highlight I don't think enough people are talking about.
Yeah, and I love removing hassle when food is involved because you don't want a hangry Bex at a theme park.
No. That's right.
I'm very excited to get. I'm very excited for a drink in the Burning Blade Tavern. That looks very, very cool. My husband wants some mead at Mead Hall because he's weird and he likes drinking mead, but I won't be doing that. Now, we did touch on Universal Parks Worldwide, so we have to bring this up, of course. It's the big news in the UK. We did a whole episode on this last week. With Lawrence from University Bedford, but as you no doubt know, Mark, the UK is getting a Universal finally at last. An amazing sort of coup for us in the UK, and as enthusiasts as you can imagine, we're all very, very excited. What's your thoughts on us finally being up there with a world beating
I know park? Finally getting a TRA park.
Yeah, I think the word is finally, right?
Yeah.
As Kev said, because there's been a lot of parks proposed over the years, the London project and other things. So, it now is a done deal. It's inked and it's happening. We have friends that we're close enough with that we call them family that live in Rushton that they're about 30 miles from the site. So, they're excited. And we're excited to go and visit them and visit the park when it opens in 2031.
2031, yeah. I think they reckon.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I think it's an amazing thing for the UK. It's like not everyone travels abroad that live in England, Wales, et cetera. So I think having that within driving distance, easy driving distance will be great. I love that they're doing a dedicated train station. So you'll be able to access the park from central London relatively easy within an hour, which is great because they can market to, say, Americans and international tourists coming to London and even for a day or, move up there and spend a night in the hotel. I believe a city walk or something like city walk is planned as part of this. So having that ability to capture people after hours is great. Mm-hmm. And above all, I think anyone in this industry that has been either on the supplier side or the operations side, when a new park, even a park of this scale comes to the market, it's not a bad thing. It's only good things can come from it because it will encourage operators to invest more, show, hey, they're opening, but we have something new. But in addition to that, I think it will drive interest in people who are not theme park people, i.e. not the three of us. So they will all of a sudden say, yes, we want to go to the new Universal Park, but hey, we haven't been to Blackpool Pleasure Beach in 10 years. Let's go see what they have going on.
That's a really good
point.
And
all of a sudden you get going in that and it becomes a new hobby per se, especially for families, right? Because everyone's looking for new things to do. So I see this as a win-win-win across the board. I couldn't be more excited for the UK getting this park.
Definitely.
It
I mean,
is very
do you
exciting.
see a similar thing in the States, Mark? Because obviously for a while, we always talk about Universal and Disney parks in the US, and obviously we're thinking about our parks in the UK. How are they going to compete almost with this incredible new theme park being built? I mean, how does it work in the States?
It's a very, I would say it's an isolated, it's a different market, right? So last year, Orlando drew over 70, that's 70 million people came through the Orlando area.
Wow.
Okay. Just
That's
try to
crazy.
process that number.
That's more
That's
than the
not,
population of the UK.
yeah.
We're at, I
So,
think, 68 million in the UK.
so maybe it was 68 million Brits and
Yeah,
5 million Americans.
probably.
So I just think, again, it's a win-win-win, right? Because it's going to bring attention to themed entertainment. It's going to bring attention to Orlando. Disney is not going to lose because of this. Disney is going to win because of this, because people are going to, want to visit everything. And that's really, I think it encourages the parks to continue to develop and build. And Disney has announced many long-term plans for Walt Disney World Park. So they're not sitting there, okay, let's see what happens, not doing anything. They have plans for all of their parks, essentially. So I think Epcot's the only one that doesn't have anything immediate on the plans, but the other three do. And as far as we have two, and I think worldwide this is true as well, but there's regional parks and destination parks. There are some that are hybrids. Here in America, a park like Busch Gardens Williamsburg is a hybrid regional and destination because Williamsburg is a vacation destination. It's right next to Virginia Beach in that area. So people combine the beach vacation with going to the theme park. Orlando is a destination. People going to Orlando are going there to visit theme parks. People who visit Kings Island, which is 5 miles from our shop here, they generally come from within a 1 to 2 hour radius at most, which is a lot of people because, you have cities like Indianapolis and Louisville and Cincinnati and Columbus and all that. So it's a different market, but in the end of the day, the more attention the industry can get in a positive light, the better it is for everyone.
Because I just worried about certain parks closing because they're not going to get the attendances. We've already seen Oakwood close this year.
You that's a park which you look quite fondly on, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, I visited there quite a bit. Just back in the days that I was doing Sky Coaster operator training, site controller training, and
Yeah, because
certification.
what was your involvement
Oh,
with Sky
wow.
Coaster?
So when I was at Ride Entertainment from 2014 to 2020, about half of my time there, I ran the division of Sky Coaster. So I was over the so
Wow.
I would literally fly all the way to UK, fly to Heathrow, pick up my car hire, drive the 5 hours all the way out to Norfolk,
That's mad.
living on cappuccinos. I don't know how, because you said when you travel from America to Europe, that first day is hard because
Yeah,
I'm asleep
you're
on a
the wrong way
plane.
around.
So, but no, I would go out there to certify site controllers on Vertigo at Oakwood, and then go up to Blackpool. There's the Sky Coaster on the South
On the
Pier.
pier.
But yeah, it's I think one difference between Europe and America in general is Europe has a higher concentration of family-owned parks that are still family-owned. We do have somewhere between 10 and 15 large-scale family-owned parks here. But for the most part, our parks are owned by corporations, whether that be Hershen, Palace Entertainment, Six Flags, United Parks and Resorts. So they're the family-owned park model is challenging because every generation that goes by in the ownership group, you have more people involved and there's more opinions, and then you have the other element of the value of the real estate, and you have the other element of, the profitability of the park versus the value of the real estate. So these are all things that are up in the air, and that's why a lot of times family-owned parks will get sold to corporations, just to kind of, get around that issue. But yeah, our industry, I mean, it is the economy right now is very, I wouldn't say shaky necessarily, but people are a little bit, anxious, we'll say. And but thus far we've had very good weather in the spring, as you guys have, and the parks that have opened have reported really good attendance. Kings Island had their not this past weekend, but the one before, had their season pass holder preview, and the place looked like, I don't know how many people were there, but the parking lot was 2/3 full. On a Friday, you know, it was Good Friday, so most people were off from school and work, but there is interest. You know, yeah. People are still going. The product is still relevant, and I'm confident the industry is in a good spot.
Yeah. Do you think people are still seeking out theme parks as a bit of a release, because when things are a little bit depressing, where better to go than a theme park? It's a happy place.
Escapism, number one. I mean, that's what the product provides in good and bad times. But if you look back here in America, just following things like, you know, a recession or even 9/11, the one reliable thing that was there were theme parks. You know, that was one of the few things that people can go and just escape life for, you know, 3 to 8 hours, let's say, and just, you know, have fun and breathe and be yourself and be with your friends and family. So that's what the industry provides. And that's a big part of what's always motivated me to work in the industry beyond the fascination I've had with it, is the product and what it does for people, just seeing people smile. And I think if you have anyone, as you guys have had so many great guests over the years on Parkcast, that's what it comes down to, is even like a John Wardley, you know, standing at the exit of an attraction that he designed, listening to the guest response. That is what makes everything worth it. All the stress, all the anxiety, everything. It's sort of like that one good golf shot you hit on the 18th hole after having a terrible round, you come back again. So,
yeah. And I guess you're in kind of you're in a weird position, because you do work in the industry and you are on that side. But on the other side, like we said, you are a through and through roller coaster enthusiast. You are a nerd, just like we are. And so you will go on your days off and your weeks off, and you'll go and find new parks, and you'll go and travel to them. And then you have the experience as a guest. And you know, we've been quite vocal on this podcast about some, you know, negative experiences that we've had at parks. There's quite a bit of negativity in UK parks at the moment. We've also had Francis Jackson on a few weeks ago, who explained what was going on it's operationally in some of these parks and why we might see some of these things. What's the sort of vibe in America at the moment, you know, as enthusiasts towards your theme parks and your amusement parks? Are they disgruntled, or is everyone in quite a good place?
I think it's a mixed bag amongst enthusiasts, because, you know, there's been a light of I call it almost like resetting, right? There are a lot of rides that were in parks that specifically to like the Six Flags side of things that just weren't sustainable, you know. You know, and this is just me saying, but, you know, King Ka is a good example. You know, groundbreaking ride, world's tallest coaster, world's fastest coaster when it opened. But, you know, ultimately, you know, the parks are a business, and you have to look at uptime, you have to look at cost to operate, whether it's staffing or maintenance and all that. So I think in the end, you know, after we get past this period, let's say, that it will be an overall net gain for the industry, because the parks are now being, you know, everybody's the planning, I'll say, feels like it's picked up again. So like long and short term planning for specific parks. So it's not just kind of let's buy this flat ride and put it here. Let's put this coaster here, you know. So I feel good about that. And that, you know, when you have planning implemented in any business, sustainability should follow, because you're not just flying off the cuff. You're going. So, and this is, you know, I think generally speaking, you know, the parks that are open, they're running well. You know, we've had some really interesting developments over here. About 2 to 3 weeks ago, I think it was announced that Palace Entertainment was purchased by Hirshen, Family Entertainment Corp, that's based down in Atlanta. They're the owners of Dollywood and Silver Dollar City. Okay. So I think the future for those parks is really bright. They bring a lot to the table from a quality standpoint. They also value theming and storytelling. So I think that is something that we lack here in the U.S. that Europe has in spades. You know, a park like Paltons, let's say, in Europe is dime a dozen. We don't really have a lot of those type of parks here. We have a lot of iron parks, I call them, where there's a lot of coasters and there's a lot of, you know, big wide midways, and, you know, it fills a need. People like it. But when I go to a park like Dollywood or Silver Dollar City, I feel like it takes it to the next level. You have the background music, you've got, you know, themed buildings and structures and immersiveness. And the Six Flags team has been executing these type of things. A great example is at King's Dominion in Virginia. which is not even an hour and a half from Busch Gardens, Williamsburg. It's a great 1-2 park punch to visit together. They developed this land called Jungle Expedition, which is in the former safari area in the back of the park. And over the course of a 5-year span, they've completely revamped the whole park. They rethemed their mock bobsleigh. They added the S&S free fly coaster and Toombeely. And then this just a few weeks ago debuted Raptera, which is the second ever, as far as I'm aware, launched B&M wing coaster, similar ride system to Thunderbird at Holiday World. And the area's got background music. It's got themed buildings. They ramped up their food and beverage. Everything just, it's very cohesive. And they're about to reopen what was formerly called Intimidator 305, the Intimate Giga Coaster. I believe it's called Pantherian or something to that effect.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people talking to me about this on TikTok, because I do this little series with my husband, who's a fighter pilot. We're trying to find a coaster which can replicate the forces that he feels as best it can.
That's the one.
Yeah, well, this is it. This is what everyone keeps saying. I mean, it's a long way to go. But everyone says that if you're going to like gray out on a coaster, it's probably going to be that one.
We don't want that. I mean, there's a point, isn't there, where you think there's a point where you don't want to be graying out on a coaster, surely.
Well, the
there's enjoyment and then there's literally like intensity to another level, isn't there?
It just takes a 300-foot drop right into a ground hugging turn, so you're just
that is crazy.
You lose vision and you gain, and usually for me I gain vision as I'm cresting the second hill, so not sure if that's healthy, but it's definitely unique.
But did you die? No.
No, I'm still here. I'm not one of those autonomous dragons walking around. I'm still here.
Last time we spoke, Mark, you hadn't done Top Thrill 2 yet. Have you managed to get on Top Thrill 2?
I didn't get to Cedar Point until August of last year. So I think it operated for a week or two.
About 8 hours.
As far as I'm aware, the ride is supposed to open with Cedar Point. When they open for the season later in May, which is very promising. I think that'll be great, because then they have Siren's Curse coming online.
Yeah, that's the tilt coaster, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's late spring, early summer. They haven't announced a date yet, but that just having essentially two new coasters in 1 year is going to be fantastic. I don't really know if I have an answer for that, Kev. I think it's a lot of elements coming together. You know, King Deca had that hydraulic launch system, similar to Stealth and Rita in the UK.
And Stealth is having big issues at the moment.
Okay.
Huge. Yeah.
So, and you know, when you look at a ride, like, as far as I know, Rita's been relatively reliable. Here in the States, Storm Runner at Hershey Park's been relatively reliable. But those rides launch from 0 to 70, 0 to 80. When you're going to 120 miles an hour, you know, things get exponentially more complicated. So I'm not an engineer, so that's most that I can say about it, but it's not as easy as just saying, well, you built this ride, it doesn't work. It's, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of the park ownership, what would you do? You know, if you had all the data in front of you and you're looking at, okay, this is my cost to operate, maintain, staff, and then this is how many riders I'm getting an hour over the course of a year. You just put everything on the table and you look at it. You know, decisions should be made using data.
Yeah. I mean, when we spoke to Francis Jackson, he made a really good point that I'd never really thought of. And it's so obvious about the age of rides. So like every year, your rides are getting older. And, you know, as the years go on, these rides are going to age and keep aging.
Sure.
And over time, you have to make a decision, you know, with the wear and tear that they go through. And I'd never really thought of it like that. And I mean, it's a great interview because he obviously mentioned a lot about ride downtime. And, you know, as enthusiasts, we like to throw our hands up in the air and complain when certain things aren't open. But it was really interesting to hear that, you know, that it's, you know, it's just part of running a theme park, I guess.
Well, I mean, look at Alton Towers as a good example. You know, their last major coaster was, 2018?
Yeah, 2018, Wicker Man,
So, I mean, we're talking 7 years ago, and they've got several rides. I mean, they just revamped Nemesis. But, I mean, is the plan for them to do that to Galactica / Air or Oblivion? Or, yeah, I mean, you have these rides that are getting up there. They're 20, 25.
I mean, fortunately, Oblivion,
I
mean, Oblivion will be too difficult to do that because it's underground. I can't see how they can do the same thing to Oblivion. than they did with Nemesis, because it's under a great big hole. Like, how do you change the track on that, you know?
Yeah, he's absolutely right, though. I mean, Age of Rides is an element on top of just day-to-day, you know, month-to-month, year-to-year maintenance and operations that a lot of people don't take into account. It is a really good point.
Well, do you think you've learned your lesson for this year? And as soon as Cedar Point opens, are you going to be like there opening week? I'm not missing it this year.
Yeah, it's going to depend on how things are here at the shop. We had a busy week last week. We had three installations happen all at the same time. Yeah.
You need to try and get on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it always surprises me that Cedar Point actually opens so late. You just think it's such a huge park.
I think it's the first Saturday in May that they open, either first or second Saturday in May. The weather in Ohio, especially up where they are on the lake, is very unpredictable. They can have snow showers in April, so it's not unheard of. You can have, you know, a 25, 30 degree Celsius day. You can have a 0 degree Celsius day. You just don't know. Kings Island just opened 2 weekends ago.
And
we're down in the south of Ohio. We're right on the Ohio River here near Kentucky. There's, you know, again, data makes decisions. They over the course of time, you look at the average weather and that will determine when it makes sense to open. It's better to have fewer operating days and more people in the park, you know, than spread your calendar and have days when you've got 5,000 people there.
Yeah. Do you, in the US, do you have a lot of 365 parks that aren't Disney Universal? Or do most parks have a closed season?
Wow, really?
That's a very European thing. You know,
we don't have any, but yeah.
Universal Disney is the only ones that come to mind. Europa Park isn't 365, but it's...
No, very short closed
very
season.
Very short, isn't
it? Same as Fantasyland.
I think where I was going with that, though, is that when a lot of the parks in Europe open, they're open 7 days a week. So it could be like, you know, Efteling's a 365 park.
Yeah.
But they, in the States, you know, for seasonal parks like the ones in Europe, it's typically weekends. In the UK, you have a lot of half terms, I guess they're called, or like August, the month of August is your summer break. Here in the States, our summer break is typically a 10-week period, where here in Ohio, for example, it starts the last weekend in May and goes till the second week of August. That school's out.
Whoa.
So the parks are open daily and really, you know, in full operating mode. And then as soon as the schools start going back, that's when a lot of the parks start losing their seasonal employees. So they can't open those days. So they go back to weekends or Friday, Saturday, Sunday and holidays.
That's interesting to know that. Yeah.
So your season is actually like super condensed because of the way your school holidays run. That's crazy.
It's super condensed. Most of our seasonal parks are open somewhere between 110 and 140 days a year, depending on the market they're in. If you look across,
Which goes back to the idea of that whole competing thing, because that's why my head was, if Universal opens in the UK, they're going to be 365, and you're going to have every other park in the UK closed for like 6 months or so, while Universal's just raking in all the, you know, all the guests. I mean, but it seems to work in America still, so.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if Universal will be 365 in the UK, and or if any of the other parks in the UK will adjust to a 365 to work against that. It'll be interesting to see, because it's unprecedented. Mm. You can't have a park like this, so we don't know yet.
Well, they've talked about it, haven't they, Bex? There was these rumors about trying to get Alton, and you know, because what they do at the minute is, you've got your Halloween season, you then have your fireworks, then they'll open a little bit for Christmas, not much, but they tend to open Christmas. They'll do something at half term in February. So there's this idea, well, they tend to try and do little bits throughout the year. So they could potentially do 365, but...
The thing with the Universal park that strikes us as different to our current parks is the amount of show buildings that are on that. You know, the rendering that we've seen, because that just suggests, well, you're really going for indoor stuff, which probably makes sense if you're going to try and open in November, December, January. I mean, it'd be great for us. I love the idea that we'll be able to go to a theme park in December not just Winter Wonderland at Hyde Park.
Weather in the UK is, as you guys know, it's all over the place. I've been in Blackpool in February, and I've been in Blackpool in August, and I've experienced 5 to 10 degree temperatures and 40 mile an hour winds. It doesn't matter what time of year.
No, it's crazy. Often we say August is one of our worst months. It should be like amazing, but we get disappointed every year. We're like, summer's going to be great, but we have our summer now, and we get excited for summer, and it's like, no, this is it. There's no more to go.
Amazing. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, for us, obviously, like we said, it's a huge thing. As much as enthusiasts will always try and turn something into a negative at some point, and I'm sure the universal negativity will come, I think at the moment we are all just super hyped for it and really positive and excited. Yeah. I know that you're a busy man, so I don't want to keep you too long. Just let us know, what's your major park plan for the year? What's the one thing that you really want to do as an enthusiast this year?
Hard to say, because Epic was that, and that's been achieved.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward. I think a ride that's kind of slipping under a lot of people's radars is Alpenfurie, Canada's Wonderland. I don't know if you guys have been following that.
It's a coaster,
multi-launch coaster from Premier Rides. It blasts, right, the track is actually going to blast out the top of Wonder Mountain, which sits in the middle of the park. And the ride features 9 inversions, so it's going to tie a record for most inversions in North America. And I think for a launch coaster, we'll have the most. It'll tie with Steel Curtain at Kennywood. But the ride it looks like it's going to have flawless pacing. And the way it interacts, Wonder Mountain has currently 3 rides operating on it or in it. There's a mock powered coaster. There is Wonder Mountain's Guardian, which is a shooting dark ride coaster hybrid. And then there is Vortex, which is an arrow suspended coaster, like Vampire Chessington.
The old school.
And then this is also built into that mountain. So you have all this kinetic energy. And Canada's Wonderland should be on everyone's list. It's a park that really slips under the radar because it's up in Toronto. And, you know, you have to go across the border. So it's not always the easiest thing. But one of the best run parks. It really is a sister park to Kings Island. I think they're very intertwined. When you're in one or the other, it feels like a similar park, with King's Dominion too. Those 3 parks are really tied together.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's on my list. I'm hoping to get up there sometime in July or August.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds really good.
Yeah. Fascinating. That's actually something I would like to get you back for, because you've just mentioned that as a park that goes sort of under the radar a little bit. I think it'd be great to do an episode with you where you give us a bit of a US itinerary that's achievable, that doesn't involve Disney or Universal Parks, because that's what so many people from the UK, we're going to, I'm guilty of it myself this weekend, going to go and do the same thing. But we go to America and we head to Orlando, or we head to Los Angeles, and we go and do the Disney Universal thing. There's so many great parks in America, and obviously it's not achievable to go and do them all. But maybe getting a couple of ideas from you for some little mini sort of American road trips, I think that would be quite
let's do a future episode. I mean, I'm happy to map stuff out. Yeah. None of these trips will include the Cheesecake Factory, Applebee's, Denny's. Yes. I'm a foodie, and they will include edible food. So I'm just
So we'll do theme park
restaurants. I'm not a big chain restaurant fan.
I love that we could do this. And for each of these little road trips, you could give us a restaurant as well that we need to visit whilst on the trip.
I think the thing about America, it is vast, and it's I'm sure it is intimidating if you're looking at it as a young traveler and trying to figure out, where am I going? What am I doing? There are lots of easy week-long trips regionally. The number one rule is, don't kill yourself. Don't try to go to Cedar Point, Magic Mountain on the same trip. Isolate a region of the country. Use one airport, like Chicago O'Hare is a great base to fly British Airways right in. And then there's 12 parks you could do in a 7 to 10 day, like a big loop, or you do a one way car hire and just drop the car off at another airport. So it's easy.
Okay. Right. This is interesting. I think this would make a really great episode. We will definitely get you back on and do this, because I think there's a lot of us in the UK enthusiasts who think, I want to go and try some American parks. I don't know where to start. So you are the man to answer that question for us.
Plus, Cincinnati could include a tour of the 3DX shop too.
Hello. Okay. I mean, right.
Are you putting on lunch?
Yeah, if you want,
Mark? What's your order?
We could do Skyline Chili. That's our famous, Cincinnati chili here.
I saw you post on Instagram. What is this Skyline thing? I've seen you talk about
The thing about it, if you're not familiar, a lot of people's eyebrows go up because you say, well, do you want to have a three-way? And since the three of us are talking right now, it sounds like something a little kinkier than it really is. But a three-way is the foundation dish that you get, like the most famous dish at a Skyline or a Cincinnati chili parlor. It's spaghetti noodles, topped with Cincinnati chili, which is very thin and runny. It's more like a Mediterranean bolognese is what I would compare it to. And then it's topped with freshly grated cheddar cheese. And that's it. So the cheese on the bottom melts into the cheddar. The cheese up top stays cool. Then you could add onions or beans, and it becomes a four-way, kinkier, tastier. Or you can add all of them, and you have a five-way.
Wow.
And
it's
a
party.
Wow. I mean, it sounds delicious. It's basically chili / spaghetti bolognese.
Like a meat sauce.
Yeah.
It has interesting mix of ingredients, Mediterranean. It's inspired by Greek recipes. So Cincinnati is a big city of immigrants. So we had Germans and Greek and Italian here. So it's like a lot of the cities in the Midwest U.S. that people kind of migrated from the East Coast after they hit Ellis Island. And, okay, that's a good place to stop. Let's invent chili.
Amazing. Perfect. Well, I'm adding that to the list. Yeah, okay. Well, we will definitely do that. We will get
There's
you back.
A Skyline Chili in Orlando. So I'll send that.
Oh, hang on. Okay. Whoa, yeah. That's just been added.
We need your feedback then, Bex. Yeah, you need to go and
as long as it's not too far out of my way, then...
No, it's just west of Disney property. It's probably from Epic. It's maybe a 15-minute drive.
I can get an Uber then. Get a lift. Cool.
That's it.
Yep. Let's do it. All right. Mark, once again, thank you so much for joining us on podcast. Your insight is always invaluable to us, and we love hearing about what's going on over in the US. Good luck with your busy year, and I hope you get on Top Thrill 2 in the next few weeks. You can report back on that for us, and we're definitely going to get you back, and we're going to do these achievable US itineraries without killing ourselves and including some great food, which Absolutely. Sounds fantastic as a theme park fan. If you have enjoyed today's episode, please do give us a like, and if you subscribe, you're going to get a notification every time we release a new episode. We'll be back next week, and I will hopefully have some epic news for you from my trip, but for now we've been Parkcast,
the UK's original theme park podcast.